The novel tells us about a young man who visits an enchanting peasant village, falls in love with an unattainable young woman, and suffers to the point of committing suicide. With this, we can see how the Romantic tradition was a major influence on the Bohemians and the Wandervogel, or wandering spirits. How those two movements have influenced the subculture of the contemporary radical left is stunning in its enormity. Let's start with the Bohemians, who valorize the traits of transgression, excess, sexual outrage, eccentric behavior, outrageous appearance, nostalgia, and poverty. This one string of virtues describes most would-be radicals today. The Bohemian parallels continue. They emphasize the artist as a rebel, a concept that would have been incomprehensible in a pre-modern era when both artists and artisans had an acceptable place in the social hierarchy. The industrial age upset that order, and the displaced artist was recast as a rebel. But this rebellion was organized around an internal state feeling, and it's no wonder that none of the subcultures that came out of this have truly helped communities that are actually disenfranchised, that face oppression under the same classes of elites that these privileged artists were born into. The Wandervogel was a counterculture in the late 19th century comprised mostly of German youth. They were motivated by rejection of the rigid moral code and work ethic of their bourgeoisie parents. The Wandervogel, however, held nothing but contempt for the realm of politics, most obviously shown in their favorite motto, "Our lack of purpose is our strength." Also popular... disgusting. Also popular in this movement was cultural appropriation. They idealized peasant lifestyles, but offered no real solidarity to the peasants who at that time were struggling to survive. Radical subcultures today tell the same story, and the costumes have only slightly changed. What does an oppositional culture or a culture of resistance look like? It may be clarifying for a historical example. So let's discuss the brave women who fought for women's suffrage in Britain. Our story sees three generations of people fighting for abolition, for labor, and for women's suffrage. Emmeline Pankhurst, a key leader in the movement, wrote, "Young as I was, I could not have been older than 5 years. I knew perfectly well the meaning of the word slavery and emancipation." That's a culture of resistance. In turn, her daughters, Christabel and Sylvia, grew up in the struggle. They used to cry because they were too young to go to suffrage meetings. At one point, Christabel said to her mom, "How long you women have been trying for the vote. For my part, I mean to get it." And Emmeline wrote in her journal, "Was there a difference between trying for the vote and winning the vote?" And she realized that if she can bring together the experience of the old with the idealism and fearlessness of the young, she would create a movement that could win. And Emmeline was right, and she did that. The women's political and social union was born. They did massive, relentless civil disobedience, including hunger strikes in prisons where they were tortured with force feeding. Parliament even passed a law specifically so that they could be tortured, and when civil disobedience worked, didn't work. Christabel escalated the troops to arson. They blew up mailboxes, golf courses, railway stations, and historic buildings. Gandhi learned much of what he knew from the suffragists, and he even subscribed to three different British newspapers to keep up with their actions. The Pankhursts were brilliant suffragists, and they were loved by their movement, and they won. However, contrary to some beliefs, women have not yet been liberated. Strong and influential activists have been fighting for generations for women to be elevated from their positions below and behind men. But just routine violence acted out on women by our culture is evidence that this hasn't happened. A recent article on violence against women said that in El Salvador, only 6% of the 8,108 complaints of sex crime actually led to convictions between January 2008 and July 2010. The World Health Organization estimates that 1 in 4 women will be raped, beaten, coerced into sex, or otherwise abused in her lifetime, sometimes with fatal consequences. Every 15 seconds, a man batters a woman, the most violent crime in the United States. The high rate of violence is not just a coincidental or just the way things are. It's what comes from deliberate socialization of men to dominate others for their own benefit. Resistance movements need a constant infusion of the courage and idealism that are the gift of youth. Resistance movements don't get anywhere without that. And they also need the experience, the stability, and the long-term planning that the elders bring. So successful cultures of resistance are multi-generational. Breaking the natural bonds between young and old means that political wisdom never accumulates. What that means now is that young aren't socialized into a culture of resistance because instead they are being socialized into popular culture created by corporate America, which has everything to gain by destroying our capacity for community, never mind our capacity for resistance.
Ooh, say that again. Really, that part is very important.
Oh, yeah. This story raises a few simple questions for today's activists. Are we after shock value or justice? Is the problem a constraining set of values or an oppressive set of material conditions? Are we content to coexist alongside injustice with all its horrors, no matter how repelled we are by those horrors? Is the self really an appropriate long-term project, or can we move on to something a little bigger? Because another 200 species went extinct today, and they were my kid. We know those who are perpetrating the destruction are also those benefiting from it, and no degree of convincing will change their minds. Stokely Carmichael famously said, "Nonviolence only works if your opponent has a conscience. These systems of power that we oppose do not have a conscience. Nonviolence is the most pervasive, abstract principle that has become dogma around our movements for social justice, with Gandhi as its figurehead. The elevation of Gandhi ignores the full story of British occupation of India. Most people in the U.S. who revere Gandhi have never even heard of Bhagat Singh, another revolutionary figure who did not espouse nonviolence and used a diversity of tactics. Without this diversity of tactics, the British may have never agreed to dialogue. We need to focus not on abstract rules or restrictions, but instead on what is going to be the most effective to stop this ecocide. We know that the tar sands, mountaintop removal, fracking, industrial fishing, industrial logging, indigenous land theft, assaults on women's rights, and further degradation of marginalized classes will continue until we actually stop them. So why do we continue to enact symbolic actions aimed at convincing rather than direct actions aimed at changing material conditions? If we are going to build an effective resistance movement, we recognize that we are going to need it all. What this looks like is a culture of resistance to the ongoing devastation brought on by civilization. We need everyone's talents, everyone's dedication, using whatever tactics can be effective in that context. We don't need a monocrop of activists, but rather we need a diverse and thriving culture of individuals and communities willing to oppose the destruction of Earth by whatever ways they can. This kind of culture is the opposite of how we live now. Neighbors who don't even know each other's names, a disconnection from the land bases we live on, and communities ripe with apathy. These result in a way of life that allows for the powerful to continue destroying the planet without being challenged by those who are suffering because of it. We can guarantee that those powerful few need it to be that way, and anyone who tries to fight back will be confronted with some mighty backlash. This is why we have to recreate our culture into supportive, politically aware communities living in communion with their respective land bases that will make it possible for their warriors to be effective. It isn't easy to pour yourself into revolution when you have to work a wage slave job just to eat, worry about costly state repression, or when you're simply alone to do work in your community. Women, people of color, indigenous people, and marginalized groups who feel the very real effects of the dominant culture must be in positions of leadership in a culture of resistance. An extremely important part of making a shift towards land-based, resistance-oriented communities is to truly engage in solidarity with the indigenous cultures who have been victims of the ongoing genocide from the dominant culture. Many indigenous people know how to live in ways that do not destroy the land base that give them life, and this results in groups of humans who could live in the same place for thousands and thousands of years. Those ways of life should be a model for a healthy and sustainable culture, and those indigenous people who know how to live this way should be given the ultimate agency to reclaim their traditions. A beautiful example of a culture that was essential in making resistance possible is the Montgomery bus boycotts of the civil rights movement. A boycott is only effective if it's focused on a weak spot in a market and if it's a collective effort of many people. Those who stopped riding the bus in Montgomery had to change how they got around to do their everyday activities, and the community stepped up to make that possible for a long enough time that it had a real impact. Prisoner solidarity, public endorsement, financial contributions, and especially simple kinds of material support like food, housing, and transportation can all be essential for non-active resistors to engage in fighting back. This kind of support for frontline activists is what needs to grow deep roots in any resistance movement in order to maintain solidarity and strength in the face of state repression. The vision of a culture of resistance is something that is rarely seen in mainstream activism, and this lack of dedicated communities is apparent in the lack of effectiveness of modern movements. This is not to deny the history of activism in the developed world. Many people are working hard for the sake of justice, equality, and a healthy environment. We do not discount these efforts, but when people talk about strategy, where does it end? Where is the end point for most attempts at change? This campaign or that action, this rally or that march, this tree sit or that lockdown, where does it end? Does it fit into a larger strategic vision that is faithful to that end? More importantly, what constitutes a victory? We protect this patch of forest or block of development in a certain area, yet the gears grind on, more human and non-human communities fall to the blade. So what's missing? What has prevented pervasive change in the human condition? A lot of the failures of modern activism can be traced back to a lack of strategy, that overall context that ties each and every action into a larger struggle, which will, if successful, bring about the future many long for. This is the heart of our message. We need a resistance movement akin to those that have come before, but nestled within a larger context of the overall problems we really face, that of civilization, capitalism, and the culture it has created to justify its existence. More importantly, the trees, the animals, the rivers, the lakes, and the oceans, future generations of humans and non-humans alike, need each and every thought, word, and deed to come from a place of awe of resistance. Thank you.
I'm going to use the computer over here.
Great, so thank you again for your time, for coming to hear our analysis. And now, that we've talked a little bit about the reality of kind of the situation that we're in, we're talking a little bit about tactics and about the strategy for deep green resistance and what we offer as a solution. But we're going to start looking at some specific tactics that have been utilized kind of in the mainstream environmental movement, and keeping in mind this liberal radical analysis of individual versus systemic change, with the goal of shedding light on why solutions that have been offered have failed and maybe for a strategy for moving forward. So the first, lifestyle choices, is probably one of the most popular mainstream environmental points of activism. In the most popular form, it's individual-centric or focused on your personal lifestyle choices. And this can look like anything from changing what we eat, how we travel, where we live, what we buy, and generally just how we conduct ourselves as members of a society. And the most prominent form of this lifestyle activism is the Buy Green movement. The green consumer movement has really taken a lot of the energy from the environmentalist movement, and taken the energy from making real change into buying green products like post-consumer toilet paper, hemp bags, things of that nature. Under this banner, we see tactics like shorter showers, consuming less, wasting less, riding bikes, growing your own food. And the idea here is to cleanse oneself of participation in an ongoing system of violence and destruction. And the idea behind it is that somehow by removing yourself from this culture of destruction, you are wielding political change. And the logical conclusion of this is a kind of personal purity, a removal of oneself from any society or any type of oppressive system. And it's important to say that there's nothing wrong with living simply or with less of an impact. It's a trait that is very noble and very very admirable in the sense of wanting to remove yourself from participating in destruction. You know, personally, I reuse a water bottle, I ride a bike, I have a garden, I buy local, all those things that are sold to us as solutions. But it must be said that these lifestyle choices are not political actions, because the idea is based on two tenets that are historically, A, unprecedented, and they don't fit into any type of timeline that we need to answer some of the problems that were laid out beforehand. The first tenet is that with these individual choices, that one day enough people will participate, and so that political change will happen. You see this with the vegetarian movement, that if enough people become vegetarian, that the corporate-owned farms will just not have anyone to buy their food, and so will fail. And the environmental movement has been around for about half a century, and we have not seen even just the majority of people who recycle, yet alone the majority of people who are willing to drastically alter their lifestyle to become more sustainable. In other words, this kind of mass movement is entirely unprecedented. And it's even in regards to the amount of vast propaganda that the mainstream environmental movements have been putting out to go green, buy green, decrease your impact. The second tenet is that if everyone did start buying these greener products or living a greener lifestyle, a more sustainable lifestyle, we would then find ourselves in the midst of a sustainable lifestyle. And this claim fails to get to the root of the problem. It's not the products of industrial production which are the problem, it is the process of industrial production which is the problem. There is no such thing as a sustainable industry. Consider this. The biggest polluter in the city of Portland is a company called Sapa Extrusions, an aluminum production company. This company specifically focuses on the production of aluminum for bicycles. And so while people in the mainstream environmental movement may think of one bicycle as being a revolution, in Portland, what thousands of bicycles look like is 900,000 tons of sulfuric acid in the air. And if you think about that, the fact that our changing our lives will somehow fix a systemic problem that we face, consider these facts. More than 90% of the water in the U.S. used by humans is used by agriculture and industry. Individual consumption is never more than a quarter of total consumption worldwide. And municipal waste, garbage, you know, waste produced by individuals and small businesses, really only accounts for 3% of total waste produced by the U.S. And so what the focus on these personal lifestyle choices does for us as individuals is it just makes us feel guilty when we drive a car, when we have to fly a plane, when we throw something out, when we forget our coffee cup and have to go use a cup that Starbucks offers us. And it distracts us from the larger issue, which is burning of fossil fuels and toxic waste on industrial scales. A second focus of the mainstream movement is legislation and or regulation. The law has commonly been used to regulate, to check unjust activities on the part of individuals or corporate entities. The most common subject of regulation is egregious industrial waste, in the form of toxic chemicals released into the air and water, as well as solid waste disposed on land and on the ocean floors. And some of the ones that we're probably most familiar with, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act passed in the 70s, and other various pesticide, herbicide limits or regulations for standards of acceptable limits of toxins in our food and our environment have been the most popular, most well-known. Some at the time when they were passed considered them to be radical, and they have been extremely effective in reducing the amount of toxins in the air and in the environment, especially compared to pre-Clean Water Act, pre-Clean Air Act. However, these regulations are only effective insofar as those in charge of the regulation are actually doing their job. And this doesn't work when those in charge of the regulation are usually the same entities who are profiting from the very destruction that is being regulated, the government or the corporations themselves. And the result of this is a plethora of loopholes where the profitable industries are not made to have to bear witness to the regulations that the law actually says. And so in this vein, with a regulatory structure like this, how can anyone be surprised that things like fracking, for example, have been granted immunity from the Clean Water Act? And that the Clean Air Act, with as much time as it has been totally useless in reducing greenhouse gases. And right now, regulation, as it is, has left 40% of U.S. rivers and 40% of U.S. streams unable to support any aquatic life, let alone for human consumption. And right now, with this regulation, we have air that is so polluted worldwide, more people die from air pollution than from AIDS and malaria combined yearly. And so I don't think that anyone in this room would argue that this is acceptable and that this is working for us. Regulation also fails at a fundamental level. This is a picture of what the boreal forest in Canada. Now it is the home of the Alberta tar sands, which has kind of been popular in the media recently. And this is probably one of the most destructive economies that we have. This is also the future of our energy supplies when you read the energy guidelines put out by the corporations. And with this idea of regulation, how do you regulate something like this? How do you regulate the entire stripping of ecosystems? And as another example, dioxin is probably one of the most toxic pollutants known to man. It's produced from all industrial practices. It permeates our food chain, and just looking at biological food chains, accumulates into the highest animal, which is human breast milk. It is a known carcinogen, has a myriad of other effects on the human body, And it's estimated that a breastfed infant between 3 and 6 months old has consumed 77 times the EPA set limit of dioxin in their lifetime. And so to the question of regulation and legislation, how much exactly is too much dioxin to give to the babies of our species? Which leads us to the third and probably most popular strategy, especially here in at the forum so far and with eco-socialism, is the idea of a mainstream clean renewable energy act. And a lot of people who tout green consumer choices also put a lot of faith into green energy alternatives to fossil fuel. And firstly, I think that calling these solutions green is misleading and irresponsible. And first of all, what most people who push for solar panels, wind turbines, geothermal, or any other vast array of these solutions don't talk about is that clean energy still requires the industrial extraction of rare earth metals, requires industrial manufacturing, and an industrial transportation structure. Not to mention, these green energy solutions are inconsistent, unpredictable, and still require the maintenance of fossil fuels to back them up. So given these facts, I think that no one can call them green, nor are they really true solutions. And if you don't believe that, there's a recent study that was put out by Bangor University, which found that the creation of oil palm plantations, which are used for biofuels, are actually releasing prehistoric supplies of carbon dioxide, inadvertently accelerating the rate of climate change.
Say that again.
The oil palm plantations that create the biofuel are actually releasing the carbon and then making climate change worse.
From the soil?
From the soil, yeah. In addition, there are populations that have to bear the effects of these industrial processes. So the people of Batou, Mongolia, see the effects of these green energy, whose crops are failing because of the radioactive pollution seeping out of the tailing ponds here, which are the products which are made by the factories that produce the rare earth metals needed for all the wind farms, electric cars, solar panels that are touted as the solution to our green energy problem. Also in Brazil, the Carioca Declaration, which was signed by 500 indigenous peoples in Brazil, called out the green economy as totally unsustainable and declared resistance to it. And in addition, in Central America, there's a growing resistance against any type of rare earth metal, specifically gold mining, down there, where people are already dying and people are already suffering. And they say that if our technology, our technological solutions, are really the green energy, it means that no one in Central America will have potable water to drink because of the pollution made by these extractive processes. But even if green energy was possible, even if lifestyle solutions could somehow save the planet and we could regulate ourselves to some sort of sanity, no one in the mainstream, and I would argue in the left and progressive movement, is talking about what even the U.S. military is taking into account into their strategy, is that our complete addiction to oil. Oil is a non-renewable resource. There may be billions and billions of barrels in the ground, but it is a finite supply. And it is widely held by most scientists that we have reached the era of peak oil, and that somewhere between 2004-2008, we have hit the peak of oil production. So that at that point, the most amount of oil that we could find has been taken out of the ground. And this means that as we progress, there will be progressively less and less oil available. So even the U.S. military and the oil industries are taking this into account into their upcoming plans and strategies. But this is something that we in the left and in the progressive movement, when we talk about these green energy solutions and revolutions that will make sustainable economies, do not take these into account. And while transportation accounts for a large part of oil usage, we forget that our entire way of life is fundamentally based upon a product that is running out. And there is no green solution to how we're going to get food, how we're going to get medicines, how our clothes and our homes will be made. And I can guarantee that the poor and the disenfranchised will be the first to suffer those consequences, as we see worldwide with global food shortages, water shortages, medicine shortages. And while this is a crisis for us, and I think that we as environmental, as a radical environmental group, want to take this into account that this will mean devastating consequences for us. Our civilization, as was pointed out, is devastating for the entire natural world. And a fact put out by the UN that was used already, 200 species went extinct today, and tomorrow another 200 will go extinct because of our practices. And so in light of this desperate reality, and the inadequate nature of more mainstream solutions, what is an appropriate and rational way for a moral human being to respond? And in the words of Liara Keith, who is one of the co-authors of Deep Green Resistance, I want to quote her argument at length. She says, is industrial civilization a war against the living world? And then subsequently, is that war a metaphor or is it real? The liberal environmental movement will say that not only is there a metaphor, it is the wrong metaphor. They would say that there is no war, that there is no enemy. There is no us and them. There are just people with good intentions, some who may be misguided. The trouble with this position is that power is not an opinion that someone can be talked out of. Power is not won by individual transformation or spiritual epiphany. Power is won by taking power away from powerful people or powerful groups of people. And so the very first thing you have to accept, before we even get to the discussion of violence, nonviolence, tactics, strategy, is that we, all of us, are in a power struggle. And who here thinks that we will voluntarily transition to a more just and sustainable way of living? So if that is the situation, I would disagree, but yeah. I think that the majority of the people in this room don't agree. And that then, if that is the situation that we're in, that we are not going to voluntarily transition to a just and sustainable way of living, and then if that's the solutions that we have, going green, signing petitions, waiting for the government to regulate things, are not going to be effective, then how does that change the way that we talk about resistance? You know, and these things, going green, signing petitions with the government, those are going to be part of the solution. But that in the 50 years of the environmental movement, they have not been effective. And so I think we need to change the paradigm of the way we talk about the solution. And so as we see it, what we need is to broaden our tactics, likely to include tactics that are not considered legal in our current system, but that have been used with success in the past. And so in the recent example that was Thaddeus had brought up, is one example that we use is the suffragist movement, which is taught in our mainstream kind of education, and they did things with massive demonstrations, letter-writing campaigns, civil disobedience. What is not often talked about is that they engaged in active property destruction, and this was what eventually led to the realization of their goals. We look at the civil rights movement, another movement that is taught a lot in our educational system. It had a strong, strong above-ground movement, but it also had a large underground and more militant aspect to the movement that was vital to the success of the movement as a whole. Internationally, we have the PLO, the IRA, which are fighting above ground and underground against imperialism for decades. In 1988, the people of Bougainville, a former province of Papua New Guinea, formed the Bougainville Revolutionary Army in response to the operation of one of the world's largest open pit mines on their land. And after years of sabotage, confrontations with the Papua New Guinea military, and reclaiming of traditional ways of life, the people of Bougainville were successful in halting the practice of the mine. And they are dubbed the Coconut Revolution, the first successful eco-revolution. And in Africa, we have Mend. And in the Niger Delta, after the leaders of their non-violent campaign were assassinated, Mend was recreated in the Niger Delta to combat the international oil companies who were destroying the land base in the Delta. With guerrilla tactics and sabotage, they have managed to cut oil production by one-third from the Delta, way more than any of the other organizations were ever to have done. And so what we're saying, as far as broadening our tactics, may come as a surprise to some people. But we should be clear that advocating for unlawful activity in the name of environmental social justice struggles is nothing new. We have seen this in every resistance movement that has ever happened and had any sort of success in history. You see this in the struggle for India's independence, from the civil rights movement, the American independence movement, the suffragist struggle, just to name a few. Unlawful activity in the name of justice has historically come in all forms, be it smuggling fugitives like the Jews under the Nazi regime, the Underground Railroad with Harriet Tubman, making safe houses, gathering sensitive information. History repeatedly shows us that resistance movements have never succeeded by following the rules of the society. And of course, decisive direct action is also nothing new to environmental and social struggles. Some of you may be familiar with the Earth Liberation Front, the Animal Liberation Front, and some of the other more popular kind of radical militant groups, such as Weather Underground, the Old IRA, the Red Army Faction. And they used a lot of decisive strategies or decisive tactics in their strategies. These groups have caused millions in economic damage to many of the dominant institutions, and the courage of the people involved that have participated in these acts is unparalleled. But as inspiring as these street protests and these civil disobedience and the Earth Liberation campaigns have been, especially those that have succeeded in actually causing significant economic damage to the people in power, we can't deny that the overall outlook after all these actions is very dismal for the Earth, because the industrial economy is still going. And the reason is because these actions have not been focused on just critical nodes of structure, the bottlenecks, the choke points of the economic structure, such as energy, transportation industries. And right now, we are fighting this huge gargantuan oppression. And the task at hand is immense. I think it's very good for us to be very clear about that. And we need to start thinking not as groups, not as individuals, but as a resistance movement, as a collective. And in that, it doesn't matter if people are on the inside of the system, on the outside. The important thing to remember is that we need it all. Civil disobedience, going green, signing petitions, direct action, decisive action. And whatever way we decide to take action, we need to choose those actions based on where power is vulnerable and compared to the resources at hand. In other words, to say where we are strong and they are weak. And so what we need is a strategy, as it was brought up before. And before we talk about strategy, I just want to talk a little bit about the goals that were kind of brought up before. And for our purposes here, this is somehow a way that I like to talk about goals. If someone is sick and they are host to some type of parasite, you're not going to be able to cure them if you don't get rid of the parasite. And this is pretty obvious. And then we apply this to a larger understanding of our system here. For humans to help the Earth even start the process of healing, we have to get rid of what it is that is causing the Earth to be sick. Whatever it is that is causing every indicator of ecological health to plummet. And if we continue using this metaphor on this big picture, we see the entire industrial economy as that parasite. It is not a hyperbole. Behaviorally speaking, the industrial economy is behaving like a parasite or even a cancer, taking only what it can take and never giving anything back except the poison and toxins that are killing us as well as the world around us. And this is something that most liberals and radicals and progressives rarely factor into their visioning of the future. This idea of any greening of the economy usually still entails taking more from the earth than you're giving back. And if we can't continue to do that, because we live in a natural world and natural bodies, and all of nature relies on dynamic equilibrium, the idea of giving and taking, no more of the imbalance. And as we wait, we continue the destruction of our lifeblood, of the world around us, of ourselves. And we are interested in giving the earth a fighting chance to survive. And to do that, we need a movement to take down the industrial economy. And we don't see any viable alternatives in the timeline that we have for action. And so before I get into the DGR strategy, I just want to clarify that DGR as a group is an above-ground group that does not participate in any type of illegal activities. What we are advocating is the creation of a resistance movement that will include parts of that. And so we call our strategy decisive ecological warfare. And it has two main goals, and we want to be very clear about the goals. The first is to disrupt and dismantle industrial civilization, and then to defend and rebuild sustainable human communities and recover the land. This will involve a legal above ground and an illegal underground movement, both keeping with a larger strategy. Under these two goals, we have five areas of strategy. The first is for an underground movement to engage in direct militant action against key nodes of industrial structure, specifically energy, transportation. The second is to participate and aid in ongoing social and ecological justice struggles. And this is, I think, with the new environmental movement, this is where movements against racism, against sexism, against ableism need to be included in this larger movement. And we have to take that and fight for those fights. Third is to defend the land and prevent the expansion of industrial logging, mining, construction, and so on, so that there is more land that is intact and more species will remain when civilization does collapse. The fourth is to build and mobilize a resistance movement that will support above-ground activities and underground activities with training, recruitment, and material support. And finally, the fifth is to rebuild a sustainable subsistence base for human societies and localized democratic communities that uphold human rights and take into account the fact that we live in a natural world and that we are natural beings. And I realize that these goals and strategies may seem drastic for some. I know for me, at first they were. And I came to DGR through the lens of health and human rights, and I would never have called myself an environmentalist. I saw the suffering in the third world, and it motivated me to act against these systems of oppression. You know, I looked around at the cities that I lived in, and I saw people living in poverty, suffering extreme racism, oppression, right next to people living in disgusting levels of opulence. And I learned about racism, about rape culture, about domination, about international health. And as a young person, I could never shake that feeling of that this is not the way it should be. There should be a better world possible. And I would assume that almost everyone here in the conference has that similar feeling, that this is not the way it should be. And as I progressed through learning, self-education, I began to see that this is not a mistake as it was brought up. You know, it was a result of a system of oppression that is working just the way it's supposed to work. And that slavery that existed in the American colonies and the slavery that existed, you know, that exists now in a global setting are not mistakes. They're not accidents. Human rights violations that occur in other parts of the world and in the U.S. are not mistakes. Women are not violated by men because men are inherently bad people. Minorities are not oppressed by non-minorities because non-minorities are uneducated. The first world does not oppress the third world because we're ignorant here in the first world. These oppressions are fundamental to the system. And then as a beneficiary of the system, I was perpetuating that nature. And so this shamed me into action. And I began to see the impossibility of reforming a system built upon domination and oppression. And as I learned more about our relationship, or lack thereof, of the natural world, I began to see that resistance was the only option viable for us as a movement. And we are literally killing ourselves and our natural world. Internationally, people are rising up against this idea of climate change, seeing the effects of climate change. And this is the same thing that here in the first world, we make the butt of our jokes when the winter is warm or there isn't snow. And we as a society are willing to blow up mountains for coal, create a modern-day Mordor for oil, engage in horrific wars just to justify our lifestyle. And at the end of the day, who gave us the right as a human species, one of millions of species, to destroy entire ecosystems? And so I like this quote. At the risk of seeming ridiculous, let me say that the true revolutionary is guided by great feelings of love. And to that I would say, if we truly love our children, how is it that we can allow them to inherit a world where it will most likely they will not be able to breathe the air nor drink the water? And if we truly love the nature around us, how can we so easily destroy it all? And if this is the destruction that we face, if this is the reality we face, of species extinction, ecosystem destruction, peak oil, how will we respond? And I want to quote Derek Jensen, who was one of the main authors of the book. If you care about life on this planet, and if you believe this culture won't voluntarily cease to destroy it, how does that belief affect your methods of resistance? Most people don't know because most people don't talk about it. Some people are too afraid of being called terrorists by those in power. Some believe that using the same tactics that have not worked for the last 40 years, whether it be protests, petitions, collaborations with corporations, breaking windows, will somehow magically start being effective. Some think a technological solution will appear that will make it all go away. Some have pinned their hopes on lifestyle changes, personal change, as if these behaviors could destroy systemic problems. And finally, some people out there just have hope, the groundless, amorphous belief that allows us to keep living these lives while all around us, and inside us, the destruction goes exponentially. The hard truth is none of this has worked or will ever work. Yet these represent the majority of our solutions to save the Earth. And those who come after, who inherit whatever's left of the world once this culture has been stopped, are going to judge us by the health of the land base, by what we leave behind. They're not going to care how we lived our lives. They're not going to care how hard we tried. They're not going to care whether we were nice people, whether we were violent or nonviolent. They're not going to care whether we grieve the murder of the planet. They're not going to care about our excuses to act or not act. They're not going to care how simply we lived or how pure in thought or action we were. They're not going to care if we became the change we wished to see, if we voted Democrat, Republican, Libertarian, Green, or not at all. They're not going to care if we had compassion for the people who are destroying the planet. They're going to care if they can breathe the air and drink the water. And in the situation that we're in, the people in power are killing the planet. They're exploiting the poor. They're murdering the poor. And we're not doing anything because we're afraid. And I think I want to be honest about that, is that I'm afraid as well. That these things that we talk about are going to have consequences. If we build a resistance movement, there will be consequences for that. But I want to live a good life. If I want to have a family and have resources and time to enjoy them. But at the same time, I love my family, my community, my fellow human beings, the sentient creatures around me and the earth itself. And that love does not imply pacifism. And so it necessitates action when those you love are facing destruction. And there are many indigenous groups throughout Africa, Central and Latin America who have stood up. In Canada, groups are standing up. Underground groups across the country, across the world, really, are already working to dismantle energy and transportation structures. Above ground groups are working to stop further destruction. We must act together. As DGR, we are a budding new group that has grown internationally, is growing very fast. And with our roles for everyone in all levels of participation in our movement. And we will love, we will rage, and we will resist together. And so we hope that you will join us. And so for more information, you can contact the Deep Green Resistance Group in New York, or you can go to the main site that has more information about our policies, about our tactics, strategies, as well as movements, local groups, and other areas. So I guess now we can open up to questions.